As we've been studying in the book of Genesis, there is a lot that we've covered. Some of you may remember we've done a 17-part overview of the Bible. We talk about, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. There was a flood and a new beginning. There was the patriarchs. And then there was the Exodus from Egypt. Well, that's where we're at. Okay. And so as we sort of overview the Bible with those 17 points, just to sort of give a general overview of the Bible, we are at the point of studying the book of Exodus. So I made a few charts here and have some questions that we'll look at in a minute. The book of Exodus just means what it says, to exit. Okay, and so that's the Greek word that was given to this. And of course, it's going out of the land of Egypt, which, as most of us are aware of. The probable date of the Exodus is about 1,446 years before Christ. And that is primarily calculated from 1 Kings chapter 6 and verse 1, when it tells about when the temple was being built, and it talks about 480 years before that's when the Exodus was. And so we know that date, and so it gives us. So this is the traditional date, at least. But 1450 is a good round figure for the Exodus. And so, not that you have to know that. It doesn't make you any closer to God, heaven, or anything else. It doesn't necessarily put many other things together, but one of those kinds of things we consider. The book of Exodus is going to talk about Jacob's family, Joseph and Jacob's family, that we've been studying about at the end of the book of Genesis, in Egypt, and they're going to grow to be a large number of people that we'll see here in chapter 1 tonight. Then it's going to tell us about God leads them out of this Egyptian bondage or slavery, and by the man Moses that he uses. After they exit, they come to a place called Mount Horeb or Mount Sinai, and there God is going to give the law, instructions about the tabernacle. We're going to find instructions about the priesthood, and then the sort of the assembly of the tabernacle, and I did sort of an overview of that. But notice this particular chart, that God is preparing a people to be God's own people. Now, we've been talking about that in the book of Genesis. As we look at Abraham, God made promises to Abraham starting in Genesis chapter 12. And we've seen the faith, the obedience of Abraham. People that say that they believe in God or believe in Jesus and do not listen, trust, and obey have no idea what Bible faith is about. And we've studied that in the most powerful way in the book of Genesis. There are lots of times you hear me say this every once in a while, and I take this from a couple of New Testament passages, but a lot of people go, "Oh, I love Jesus, I love Jesus." Make a lot of noise. But Jesus says that if you do not accept me and my word, then I will not confess you. I will not recognize you. Luke chapter 6 and Mark chapter 8 and verse 38, we see those passages that make those very statements. Well, the reason I say that is because what we have been seeing throughout the book of Genesis, the men that are brought to the forefront like Abraham and Joseph we've just finished studying, are men who trusted and obeyed God. And it took many, many years for what God had promised them and what God was going to do to unfold. But what we have seen is that they trusted God for long periods of time. They just kept marching and doing what God said. And God, as always, is faithful to his promises. God will bring about exactly what he says. Matthew? Okay, I think that's certainly so. As we saw in the study of Genesis, God brought them out of Canaan to Egypt because of the influence of Canaan, as well as, you know, there was a bit of the scattering there among their families themselves, and as we notice that. And so God's going to bring them together, and we're going to talk about that. Chapter 15, verse 20, we looked at last class. Joseph's brothers meant it for evil, but God meant it for good, to preserve this family that you're talking about. Genesis chapter 50, verse 20, the last chapter of the book of Genesis. And I've used a chart up here talking about, you know, here's the providence and the hand of God. Again, it is incredible to me how much of God's providing and providence throughout the Bible is non-miraculous. Sometimes people get thinking, well, the only way God can provide is he does some extraordinary miracle. And that's not so at all. What God did was he provided again and again and again using just ordinary means. We see that throughout the New Testament. We see that in the Old Testament. And there were times that God does miracles. Now, what's going to happen as we study the book of Exodus, God's going to do a whole bunch of miracles so that Pharaoh will know, so that Egypt will know, and so all the world around there is going to know, I am Jehovah God. And this flurry of miracles, we talk about them as the plagues, and then the things that follow after that, the parting of the sea and various things, it is an expression of evidence that I am God. Now, what happens later on in Israel's history, they quit listening to the word of God, and so he later sends another prophet like Elijah and Elisha, who do another big flurry of miracles, and say, how long are you going to go limping between the two, the old King James said. If Jehovah's God, serve him. If Baal's God, serve him. And so God provides these miracles to show that the word that is being spoken is God's word. By the way, they were saying, go back and listen to the law of Moses. That's the word, the covenant that you were given. And that's primarily the job of the prophets. We think about prophets foretelling the future. But so often what we see as we study the prophets, they're saying, you need to get back to the word and the covenant that the nation of Israel and God have, which we're going to be studying about here in Exodus. Listen to God. As a matter of fact, the last chapter of the Old Testament, Malachi chapter 4, I think it's verse 6, says, listen to the law of Moses. That's the law, that's the covenant they were under. The Old Testament closes out saying that. You listen to the word. I find it interesting. Now, this chart, God is preparing a people to be God's own people. That's what we've been seeing here in Genesis. And he's used Abraham's offspring, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob that we've studied about. And Jacob's son Joseph was sold into Egyptian bondage. And there, by a series of events, God allowed Joseph to be able to interpret dreams. He interpreted Pharaoh's dreams about 7 years of plenty and 7 years of famine. He was raised to the second ruler of Egypt, and he was able to bring all his family up into Egypt. And so we've been studying about all those things. But in the midst of all that, God was providing and preparing for his people. Now, would somebody read for us Exodus chapter 19, verses 3 through 6? I know that's way ahead. Okay, Tommy? Exodus chapter 19, verses 3 through 6. This is when they get to Mount Sinai, and they are about ready to receive the law. Okay, Tommy? So there, as the Ten Commandments and the Book of the Law are about ready to be given, the law is about to be unveiled, if you would, God is saying, listen, if you trust me and be faithful to me, we'll have a relationship. You will be unique among all the nations. And many of you in here are aware of the word Gentiles just means nations. In contrast to the Jewish people was the nation. That's what he's talking about here. I will make you a unique people. And it was going to be through that unique people that what you see here happens. Ultimately, Jesus will be brought into the world and salvation would be made available to all mankind. And so this book is going to continue what we started in the book of Genesis. God is making a way. God has a plan. And he was making a way by which to bring Jesus Christ into the world to be the sacrifice, the Lamb of God, so that we can have a way to be brought back together with God. Now, between the book of Genesis closing and the Exodus is some 430 years. And I have some passages here. The bottom two talks about 400 years, the top two, 430. The bottom two is just rounding off. The bottom in Genesis chapter 15, 13 through 16 is when God made a covenant with Abraham and said, my people are going to be in a foreign land for 400 years. They're going to be bondage there. He's just talking about generalities. The specific was 430 years. But the reason I really made this chart was for this purpose. How long is 430 years?
Timeline of our country.
Good.
The beginning of our country, and that's just eons ago in our
mind. Yeah, and that's the exact thing I was thinking. You know, this is almost twice as long as the United States has been into existence as a nation. What we do, though, we say, oh yeah, 430 years. Okay, that was last week. Now, Exodus starts this week. But two time frames of the nation of the United States, how long we've been in existence, that's this time, roughly speaking, between Genesis and Exodus. Okay, I think that's exactly so. And I didn't chase this down. I've got some information. But the projection of who some of the pharaohs were during that period, they don't know always and exactly. But it seems like it was a different dynasty of pharaohs as well. There was a shift in there. And so that may play into that. Okay. But the bottom line, when we get to Exodus chapter 1, we're going to see that Joseph and his family no longer has the relationship that was once there with the pharaoh back at the time of the famine and all that took place. Now, something else I was studying, actually with Turner and Evie today, I ran across this, and someone made the comment about, if you notice the word author is associated with the word authority. It's his story. You get that? You read a book, the author says, here's the book. Now, you may not like the book, you may not like how it goes, you may not like what he did with it, here, there, yonder, But it's his book because he authored it. It's for the story purpose. It's his authority. It's written as he gave it. As we look at the narrative of God's story and what God has done, his scheme to redeem man, he is the author of that. We can talk about a passage in the New Testament. Jesus is the author and the perfecter of our faith. He has the authority. It's his story. It's God's plan of salvation. And so that's what we're looking at as this unfolds in Genesis and moving on into Exodus. Now here's a map, and I'll have another one. You'll notice this is a map I put up here before, but the top red circle is the land of Goshen, and that was the area where Jacob and all his family initially settled as we looked at the end of the book of Genesis. And as we look at that location, you'll see up to the right and to the top, that's the land of Canaan, where they came from down into Egypt. And then here's another map of the area of Egypt. And I put a little red box up here, and it talks about Ramesses and Python. And as you look at Python and Ramesses, in verse 11, what are those? And I'm going to this now simply because I got a map up here. I got the slide to it. What are those in verse 11 of chapter 1? Okay, so storage cities and storage facilities. They're making these storage facilities. And so it says, so they appointed taskmasters over them to afflict them with hard labor, and they built for Pharaoh storage cities, Python and Ramesses. So that's where they're at on the map, and that little red box. And you see that's in the Nile Delta area. And so that's sort of the geography of that. So when we go through there, you'll be able to see that. Now, I'm not trying to sidetrack here, but you notice here is the Nile River, one of the things that Tommy has seen pictures of lately. It's his wife who just got to see the source of the Nile River. That is so cool. That's just a little brook spring, you know, like every river begins. And so here a week or two ago, that's where she was at. And hopefully when she's back here in a week or two, she'll be able to tell us some more about that. The book of Exodus, this is sort of an overview of the book to help us out. The first 12 chapters are telling us about the Israelites being in bondage, their slavery, God raising Moses, the plagues, and so here's what's going on, why they're in Exodus, and they then are going to exit at that point. Verse chapter 13 through 18, then they exit, they cross the Red Sea, go to Mount Sinai, where they will receive the law. And that's what chapters 19 through 40 then are about. And you'll notice I've got this listed as subtopics under that, because once they come to Sinai, that's where they are at throughout the book of Exodus. And so in chapters 19 through 24, they're going to get what we call the Ten Commandments of the Law and the Book of the Law. And so the following verses and chapters to the 24th chapter is talking about the laws that are associated with the law that God gave this Jewish nation. And then in chapter 25 through 31, it gives instruction about the tabernacle and the priesthood. So we're going to see that in this book. In chapter 32 through 34, that God's made this covenant with them back in chapter 19. They said, we'll do it, we'll listen. And then what happens? They build a golden calf in chapter 32. And you remember the tables of stone that God gave Moses? He went up the mountain to get. When they came back and they were in rebellion against God there, he tossed them down, they broke. And so he goes up to the mountain to get the second set of the Ten Commandments. And so we'll be studying that here in chapter 33 and chapter 34. 32 is the golden calf and the breaking of those stones. And then in chapter 35 through the end of the book, he's going to talk about the construction of the tabernacle. And so again, we'll talk about all those things. But anyway, that's sort of an abbreviation of what's in the book of Exodus that we're getting ready to study. And this is all going to unfold in a very important and a powerful way.
Yes, sir. Tabernacle
still exists
to this day?
Does it exist till now?
Yeah.
No. What happened is that God gave instructions for the building of a tabernacle, and they used that for several years. When they come into the promised land, they first set it up at a place called Shiloh, and then later it's going to be moved towards to a place called over Jerusalem eventually. David once decides he wants to build a temple instead of a tent. So I've got a big fancy house, and God's people have a tent. And God never instructed to do that, but he made this appeal to God, and God said, well, I'm not going to let you do it, David, but I'll let your son Solomon. And so Solomon then built a temple, and that replaced the tabernacle. Later in Old Testament history, that's going to be destroyed because of the unfaithfulness of God's people. So anyway, does that answer, give you direction to that? And so exactly what happened to the tabernacle itself, I don't know. We're not told. But it was taken out of the way. But God gave exact instructions about how to build the tabernacle. Hebrews chapter 8 and verse 5, it says, he told Moses, you build it exactly like I've shown you. And later then, when Solomon is building the temple, guy says, you build it exactly like I'm showing you. Tells him the same thing. Because it relates and has to do with something later on. And that's the spiritual temple of the new covenant. Okay. But I hope that fills in a little bit more. That's more than you asked, but maybe to... Yeah, great question. Yeah, good question. This is another outline because the time is getting away from me. I'm not spend much time here. But the need for redemption from Egypt. They're in slavery there, and God's going to deliver them, and I just don't have time. But this is just another outline. You're certainly welcome to that. And what I want to do now is start looking at some things in this chapter. The first seven verses of this particular chapter, here we go again. I don't know what I got going on here. There we go. The question is, what happened to the sons of Israel? Verse 1 down through verse 6 lists the names of Jacob's offspring. And then in verse 6 it says, Joseph died and all his brothers and all that generation. So where we left off in Genesis, here he says all those people died. And a bunch of times passed. But what happens in verse 7? Somebody read verse 7 for us.
But the people of Israel were fruitful and increased greatly. They multiplied and grew exceedingly strong, so the land was filled with them.
Okay. And so Jacob's offspring, or Israel's offspring, just kept increasing, multiplying in an unusual way, spiritual miracle growth. God caused, blessed them, and they just kept multiplying. And as Matt mentioned a moment ago, there in the land of Goshen, they're sort of their own entity over there, which is exactly what God was trying to accomplish. A people for his own possession. We just read in Exodus chapter 19 and verse 6, you're going to be my nation. Well, that's what he's been developing here in the land of Goshen. And they are multiplying greatly. So there's a lot of them by now. Now, what would you think that would mean? There's a lot of them. They grew, they greatly multiplied, they became exceedingly mighty. Remember, they started out about 75 people back in Genesis. What we find, if you just want to write down chapter 12 and verse 37, there's 600,000 men plus women and children. That's a bunch. I can't even get all those people in my car. 600,000 men. Later when we get to the book of Numbers, they will be numbered there in 600 and so many thousand men that are able to go to war. They're at certain age and certain things that way. Plus the women and children. So by the time they leave the land of Egypt in the Exodus, we're talking about a massive number of people. We're not talking about a squad of people or a platoon or a company of people, you know, trotting off across the desert. We're talking about a massive number of people. But here it's described as God has blessed them during this period of time, and he's growing them into this great nation. That's where he's headed with this. Questions about that before we go far? Shannon.
I think one thing that's interesting that sticks out when you read this is that they were described as being exceedingly strong. But if you look at how, you know, the position that they were in and how they were treated, it's like this unrealized potential. Because, you know, they were slaves. They may have even counted themselves as nothing, perhaps, because of the situation that they were in.
Okay.
But because of their number and obviously because of God's plans for them, they were actually a significant force.
Okay, they were. And when we get down to verse 10, I'll go ahead and put this next question up here if I can get this thing to go forward. I did it the way I was supposed to this time, buddy. How do things change for the sons of Israel? Verses 8 through 14. So I plumped these together, knew I'd be short on time. And if I wasn't going to be gone next class, I would just back away from it. But I told Will I'd get through chapter 1. And so what happens here after they have grown to this great number? What takes place? Verse 8. Sam, you mentioned earlier this.
King forgot why they were there.
Yeah, king forgot why there. A new king arose. A power arose. When we talk about the word Pharaoh, that's not a proper name. You know, it's not like Tommy. It actually was a name that meant great house. Here's the important house, the family. So it was just a kingly title. And so there were whole series, dynasties of pharaohs. And so when we see a pharaoh mentioned down in here, we find out, like down in verse 11, and they built for Pharaoh storage cities, this king. That's what that word means. He's of course, we could just say, you know, he's the king. But Pharaoh, it was an Egyptian word that meant that. And so as you look at this then, the king said in verse 9, they're more and mightier than we. What was he concerned about in verse 10, sort of going along with what Shannon was just talking about? He throws another dimension in here.
Numbers, not that they would be unfaithful and war against them, but if they would align themselves with one of their enemies.
Okay.
Before that would push them
off. Okay, yeah, so some enemy come in here, and they align themselves with this enemy. Hey, we're going to be a fix. It used to be, and again, I won't go down this road, but one of the things that they used to talk about was China. They just had sheer numbers. And they would use illustrations back when I was a kid about you could put so many Chinese abreast and march them off into the ocean, and reproduction was taking place so fast it would be endless, because they were being born so fast that even marching them off into the ocean that way, they would just, you could, large numbers. And so, well, here, you know, they're worried about the numbers, they're worried about the things don't go right. And so what happens then? How do things change here for the sons of Israel? What does Pharaoh and crew do? Okay, force them into slavery. And we're going to see more of this as we'll lead to the study next week. But you'll notice that in verse 11, they are slaves in Egypt. They have taskmasters over them. God is going to deliver them from slavery. Now, since I don't have much time, we'll not go here long. But you remember in Hebrews chapter 3 and 4, it tells that we have been made a promise of a promised land. We have been brought out of the slavery and the dominion of the devil and sin in Christ. And we are headed toward a promised land. And so there are great lessons in here for us in that parallel matter. Hebrews chapter 3 and 4, if you want to read about that. Chapter 4 says, we also have had promises made to us. And so he's using these things that we'll be studying about here. And so they are in slavery here. And by the way, when God made this covenant with Abraham back in Genesis chapter 15, he said it would be enslaved to them for this period of time, as he makes this nation from them. And so they increase the affliction and the task. And it says in verse 13, the Egyptians compelled the sons of Israel to labor rigorously. And how did that impact their lives in verse 14? Made their lives bitter. It was just hard. Now, as Will continues in this study, as Will continues in this study, you're going to see this is going to appear again. Things are going to be tough for them. And I'll not spoil that by going farther, but notice here that this rigor is imposed upon them. Their lives are bitter. And so what happens then is the king decides to do something else. Let me go ahead and catch up with my questions here. Greater affliction. They multiplied. It says in verse 12, the more they afflicted them, the more they multiplied, and the more they spread out, so that they were in dread of the sons of Israel. So this thing, even though they put them under affliction and taskmaster slavery, if you would, I hate to do this, but I guess I'm going to have to update this system. The one that I'm using on here has the Bible program on it I've used forever. And with the next update after this one, it's no longer compatible. So I've hung on to it because it's no longer supported. And anyway. So what's the king's command in verse 15 through 21?
Kill all the newborn.
Okay. He's going to tell these midwives in verse 15, when baby boys are born, kill them. Let the baby girls live. The men are that which they consider a military threat as they keep increasing in number. But what happens, even though the king gives a decree, what does it tell you in verse 17 in the midwife's response? Yeah, why? They do what's wrong. It says they feared God, my translation says. The midwives feared God more than they feared the king. Yeah, that was a woman who was involved with delivering babies. Yeah, and we still use those today. If you go into hospitals, certain places where they use midwifery is what they call it, where you, instead of having the doctor and all the stuff that normally goes with a hospital childbirth, that they have someone trained in delivering babies. So here are a couple of the Hebrew folks of the nation of Israel, midwives, that help do that. And so the king tells these nurses that help with the delivery, you kill the babies. But these women feared God. Now, again, since my time is gone, if you want to write down Hebrews chapter 11, verse 23 and 27, Hebrews chapter 11, verse 23 and 27, it talks about Moses' parents. Rather than listening to the king, they're going to send Moses to safety. And later, Moses chose rather to suffer ill treatment of the people of God and be in defiance of the king of Pharaoh. So those two passages tell us the same thing. But here's these women. And frankly, they are heroes. And it says in verse 20, God was good to the midwives, and the people multiplied and became very mighty. And it came about because the midwives feared God that he established households for them. So God blessed them. And then that takes us to the next point down in verse 22. The next command, by the way, when Pharaoh said, well, why aren't you doing this? What did they say? What did the midwife say to the Pharaoh? Okay, these Hebrew women are stronger and sturdier, and they're giving birth before we get there, and so the baby boys are gone before we get there. So that's what they tell Pharaoh. And so verse 22, then Pharaoh commanded all his people, not just the midwives, all his people, saying, every son who is born you shall cast into the Nile, and every daughter you shall keep alive. That's going to lead us in to chapter 2 and following. And so that's where that leaves off. Questions or comments before we close? We're a couple minutes over already. I spent a bit of time there in some of my introductory charts. Yes, sir?
So when it comes to why this parallel, this is kind of like a man, I wanted to lose power to himself.
Yeah.
Israel.
Yeah. Keep studying through Exodus with us here, and it'll answer that for you. Yeah. It's going to tell us that God's going to give Pharaoh and the Egyptians some lessons. Yeah, his pride, his ego, we talked about ego about something the other night. His ego is there. He is the most important king in the world. The Egyptian is his world power at this time. And so I am the big boss. Why do I have to listen to anybody? He's going to get an education. Okay, great, great question. All right,
it's
Louis.
Ironic, though. I'm sorry.
What's that?
I was just going to say it's ironic that he was so scared of the Hebrew people turning on him. He essentially ensured it. I know it didn't play out the way that he thought, but
yeah.
He essentially ensured their hatred of him anyway.
Exactly right. Louis?
And you can see the fear that he has. He's kind of going about it backhandedly without alerting all of the Hebrew fear that
okay.
Place there that he's trying to diminish their power.
Okay.
But it doesn't work out for him. Seems like he could have dealt harsher with the midwives, like we get it to make sure this happens, but
yeah. Yeah, but it's hard telling what all else, you know, took place in here. This is an abbreviated thing. Okay, this happened, and this happened, but you're right. And so God bless the midwives because they trusted God. Okay. All right. We'll stop there for tonight. Thank you for your participation. Look forward to our continued study.